Me.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this,
I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
Cool Zone Media.
Hello, and welcome to Cool People Did Cool Stuff, your weekly reminder that sometimes people try to do things to stop the bad things. I'm your host, Margaret Kiljoy, and with me today is a guest who's named Sarah Marshall. Hi, Sarah.
That's true. Hi, Margaret. I'm so happy to be here.
Yay.
As you do a cool thing.
Sarah is the host of You're Wrong About. Did you ever go through a period where it was going to end with dot, dot, dot in the title?
I feel like there's like an implied dot, 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 and I've seen it rendered that way. It's like the question mark and who's the boss.
Yeah. Do you think that every now and then they accidentally wrote it as who is the boss?
Or like, who's W-H-O-S-E the boss? Like, who's the boss is this?
Yeah,
it's got to be someone's. Is it yours, Jeff?
I wonder, it might have been a different, it was one of these things, one of these very simple, the way that English and contractions work, where I was working on this activist zine during Occupy or whatever, and we were like put out a new zine every week with news. And my co-editor was like, who wrote this fucking article? And looked at me and was like, it couldn't have been you. They used like, who's wrong? And I was like, I wrote that one. We have not had much sleep.
Really, as you can see, my faculties are deteriorating.
Yeah, it is 2011 and Occupy has destroyed all of our brains. What hasn't destroyed our brains is our producer, Sophie. Hi, Sophie.
Hi, Sophie.
Hi. I just wonder, Sarah, question for Sarah. How many times are you having a conversation with somebody and do they go, that could be something that people are wrong about? Maybe you should do that as a topic for your show. How often does that happen?
You know, I hardly socialize, so not that much, but like probably on average 3 times a month. And my favorite is when it's on something that, like, if you've listened to the show, it really like has nothing to do with anything we've ever talked about. But it's a thing to, you know what? I'm sure people say this to you both, where people are like, I'm sure there are too many podcasts already. I'm sure you don't think people should start podcasts. And I'm like, no, start your own podcast. And then you won't try and get me to do it for you.
That.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, I think you do socialize more than that you think, because I saw you this week and I'm seeing you again.
That's
like
true.
Days.
Well, that's the Sophie exception.
I'm like 3 times a month, honey.
Honey.
Wait, how many, Sophie, how many like hard introverts do you have in your life? Like, how many of us are you our primary socialization?
Well, that's because that's because we all find each other.
Yeah, fair enough.
We all find each other. We're like, do you want to do
Sophie, you're like the center of the wagon wheel.
We're like, do you want to do something that's not overstimulating with me? Great. Low stakes. Let's go.
Yeah.
One other our audio engineer is Danil.
It is Danil. Hi, Danil. I love you.
Hi, Danil.
Hi, Danil.
Our theme music was written for us by Unwoman. Sarah, Have you ever heard of the environment?
Ooh, yes. I'm in Portland, so we heard of the environment 2 years before everyone else.
That actually is oddly the theme of this.
Whoops.
kind of, because the next question I had written in my script is, have you ever heard of the Pacific Northwest?
I have, yeah. I know of it and its works. I'm a fan.
How about the Earth Liberation Front?
I don't know, because I feel like when I was growing up, there were all kinds of environmentalist groups, but they all kind of blurred together in my little brain. So I honestly can't tell you.
Fair enough. I don't know how much you tell the public. Where did you grow up? You don't have to answer this.
Oh, yeah. Well, I grew up outside Portland.
Okay. So in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, in the Northwest, in the Portland. I definitely call the Portland area home and Oregon in general. And then, of course, if you're in Portland, then like we claim Southern Washington as kind of ours. Sorry, Washington. But you get to come over here to avoid sales tax, so it's nice. And so, you know, to me, an iconic Northwesterner is famous for doing something that was dangerous to themselves. And so my favorite is Harry Truman, the old man who refused to evacuate because of Mount St. Helens blowing up and, you know, apparently died in the blast like he wanted.
It was his choice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's sort of related to what we're going to talk about. It's definitely about people in the Pacific Northwest deciding to make some decisions that in some ways didn't go well for them. And in some ways.
But did we say they were going to?
Yeah, exactly. They didn't really make the claim that they were getting out of it unscathed.
Magpie, am I right that maybe Sarah might know them better by their nickname, the Elves?
Maybe.
It's like familiar, but in the sense of like, I feel like, you know, if you go to the country fair a few times, then like you overlap with people who have more serious thoughts than let's eat mushrooms in the woods.
There is a non-zero chance. This is a very high chance that many of the convicted terrorists we're going to talk about today were at the Oregon Country Fair at some point or another.
Amazing.
Because today we are going to talk about a bunch of eco-anarchists, punks and hippies who in the 90s and into the early aughts caused millions of dollars in damages to earth-destroying machinery, all without killing or injuring anyone.
Nice.
They were branded as terrorists. They were hunted for years. One of them is still being hunted today. Their movement, or at least the, you know, the specifically named Earth Liberation Front, fizzled out, and their tactics remain divisive. I have no doubt that if there are people around to write history books 100 years from now, they'll be seen pretty clearly as heroes.
Mm-hmm.
Not as like the John Brown of the environment, because they didn't actually spark anything. That's not true. They sparked some very specific things. Quite a lot of things. But
I see what you did there.
Yeah, because this fire. Yeah, totally. Yeah. They are real flawed heroes. Their actions may or may not have been strategic. A bunch of them regret the choices that they made. However, a lot of what we have about them regretting the choices they made are them talking to judges who are deciding how many years they should spend in prison.
Hmm.
And I have a feeling people are more sorry for their crimes when someone is holding a gun to their head.
Sure.
But they showed that some people are willing to go pretty fucking far in order to save the world from boiling. And we're going to talk about them.
I'm excited.
And don't worry. We're going to start with the French Revolution. Why not?
Why not? I'm always saying that. Honey, can we have the French Revolution? Let's just stop. It's on the way home.
We have a French Revolution at home. And then the French Revolution at home is just guillotine earrings that some hipster is wearing. So, not because the French Revolution was so great, does so many things start with the French Revolution, but because Europe colonized the world, so all of their random ideas have outsized impacts.
Hmm.
But we're going to start with a mathematician who served on the Revolutionary Committee in his neighborhood during the Revolution and faced the same thing that many of the revolutionaries did, which was that he immediately almost got guillotined himself. His name was Jean-Baptiste Joseph Fréhet. He is not super important to this story, but I like drawing red yarn across a conspiracy board. That's basically my job. And he ties into the French Revolution, which means after helping bring democratic ideals to the West, he, you know, was arrested twice by the revolution, was going to get guillotined. But he didn't. Instead, he did a lot of science. Like, he writes papers with names like On the Propagation of Heat in Solid Bodies. And this is not the name of art porn, to my knowledge. If someone makes it.
It's still available.
Yeah. He did something really important to our story. In 1824, he was like, hey, everyone, I did an awful lot of math. And the Earth should be way colder than it is, based on how far away it is from the sun. Something is insulating us.
Wow.
Yeah. So he's a 19th century scientist. So he gets obsessed with blankets and insulation, and he wraps himself in a blanket all the time for the rest of his life.
That's what I want to do for different reasons.
Well, here's the reason to be careful with cozy core. He tripped on his blanket, fell down the stairs, and died.
Oh boy. You got to take the blanket off sometimes, but I appreciate the dedication.
Yeah. There is a literal and metaphorical lesson here.
Wait, I didn't know that was a thing. I don't like that.
Which is why we should destroy stairs. No other lesson could be learned from this.
No.
Before he died, I just like going into the personal lives of these men because it's never what people talk about. He never married. He wrote a detailed description of how handsome and in love he was with a certain male doctor. Mm-hmm. So, of course, the internet is like, well, he was never married and he made friends with a lot of women. So he was a womanizer.
Mm-hmm. Because straight men love to hang out with women.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's the rare ones that do. And then half of us come out as trans. So the next scientist in this chain of, oh shit, global warming is actually happening, which we all figured out in the 19th century, and it took until the 21st century before even people would admit it. Anyway, was a woman named Eunice Newton Foote, and no one listened to her because her last name was Foote. No, just kidding. It was because she was a woman. She was also politically involved. Global warming has always been a woke conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, she was American and she was in the 19th century and she was a woman. She was a white woman. So she was involved in all the U.S. stuff at the style at the time. She was a fierce abolitionist. She was into getting women some basic rights. And while we're at it, no one should be allowed to drink alcohol anymore.
Mm.
Two out of three.
You know, yeah, I'll take a partial win.
Yeah. I'll probably never directly cover the temperance movement on this podcast because it's not cool people did cool stuff, but it ties into it all. Like there's all this stuff that around the turn of the century, like eugenics and temperance that were like not the right wing issues that you would picture them as today.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, she married a feminist man. And since she was a woman and her science was like amateur, right? Because she was a woman, everything she patented, she had to patent under her husband's name because women didn't have enough legal rights to sue over patents. She discovered the insulating properties of CO2. Not in 1956. She is not a lich or a vampire, to my knowledge. In 1856, despite what Margaret wrote in her script, in 1856, she presented her theory that, quote, an atmosphere of gas would give to our Earth a high temperature, and if, as some suppose, at one period in its history, the air had mixed with it a larger proportion than at present, an increased temperature from its own action, as well as from increased weight, must necessarily have resulted.
So we've definitely had time to prepare.
Yeah.
Embarrassing.
They knew that CO2 warmed the atmosphere before we started putting CO2 into the atmosphere at scale with the industrial society.
Well, when you put it that way, and to quote Jack Nicholson in The Shining, you've had your whole fucking life to think things over. What good's a few more minutes going to do you now?
Oh, God, that is what's going to happen. So she had this theory and she went to go present this theory, but I'm just kidding. She didn't present her theory. She had to have a male friend present her theory because women did not present such things.
She had to put a bunch of dachshunds in a three-piece suit and hope for the best.
Yeah. And the man who did present it started off by saying science was of no country and no sex. So the men in her life aren't like capitalizing off of her. They're actually supporting her and they're really fucking annoyed about all this too.
Good for them.
Yeah. However, they're hanging out and friends with a woman, so clearly woman. Well, one of them's married to her, so I guess he's probably so, you know, womanizing her.
No, isn't womanize like, say, womanize is, it sounds like a term like Martinize or Simonize, like, you know, just a quick and easy process for turning someone into a woman. That would be ideal.
Let's push for it. Yeah.
Yeah. 1 hour womanizing.
Yeah. The womanizer store.
Or, you know, it's free.
All these horrible misogynist men go there thinking that something different's going to happen
yeah.
than what does.
Now there's an 80s comedy. Okay, so this is like one of those pieces of news where you're like, wow, humans are capable of both so much and so little. Like, we discovered CO2 yeah. would be a problem before we started doing the problem.
Yeah. Next up is Svante Arrhenius, who is a Swedish chemist. He was an early birth control advocate, tying into that other problematic movement, eugenics. Mm-hmm. But in 1896... he was the first person to actually calculate global warming based on human-caused CO2 emissions. This is, you know, a couple decades into the CO2 emissions, and he's like, oh, let's math this out. And he put it together. He was also kind of a dick. He married one of his former pupils, which is essentially never a good look. And then he wound up on the Nobel Prize committee, and he just, like, played favorites, and he got all of his friends' Nobel Prizes, and all of his enemies, like, didn't get them. But... he calculated global warming. Flawed people do real interesting things. That should actually be the title of this show.
That can be your spinoff TV series.
Yes, please give me the TV series. By the 1950s, you now get a Canadian this time. So we got four different countries represented in this particular quick overview of people who called this a long time ago. And his name is Gilbert Plass. And he
Very
started
Canadian
making...
name.
Oh, yeah, totally. Also, okay, now to picture this man. This man is the ultimate, like, 50s stereotype man. He is a stamp collector. He is a classical music DJ. And he worked on the Manhattan Project.
What? Wow. So this guy is, like, played by David Strathairn in the biopic.
I don't know who that is.
I hope. He's Mr. Goodnight and Good Luck. God, I really sound like my mom these days. Where you just, like, instead of the person's name, you just grope for, like, the name of the thing you can first think of them being in. So instead of Helen
it's
Hunt,
okay.
you just call her Mad About You.
Magpie usually doesn't get most references.
Yeah. Nice. I'm thinking of like, you, David Strathairn, I hope people agree with me, is like...
looking him up.
The archetypal, handsome, long-suffering, thin-lipped mid-century man. He also played Mr. Lowenstein in A League of Their Own.
Oh yeah,
none
no,
of this
okay.
is relevant.
Okay, but I've seen The League of Their Own, and I've now looked him up. Yes, this man
did
should play him in the biopic.
Did we also see that in theaters?
Yeah, we did.
Holy
at the Academy.
We've had a
good year.
We've done it.
Portland is a second rate city in many ways, but we're a first rate second run movie city. I'll have you all know.
Mm-hmm. I did see a lot of good movies at the cheap theaters there.
But okay, so we have a serious man, if you will.
Yeah. He starts making predictions about climate change that are more or less accurate now. 70 years ago.
Good Lord.
There is someone doing the math that more or less lines up. So we've known about human-caused climate change for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Next, we're going to talk about the first ELF. People talk about the ELF, and they're usually talking about the main ELF, the Earth Liberation Front. But there was a different group of guerrilla, eco-radical people, probably just one guy, but it had a group name. This ELF was called the Environmental Life Force. This is probably one man who did a few actions in 1977 in California and Oregon. His name is John Hanna. He was I don't know if he's still alive, but he was alive as of 2008 was the last interview I read with him. He was an anti-war vet in the 60s. He'd gotten out of the military before the Vietnam War. And then he like went off to school to study marine biology and do environmental stuff. But then he got caught up in the anti-war movement, dropped out of school. He was in Students for Democratic Society, but it wasn't radical enough for him. So he had this whole elaborate plan where he was going to go to Thailand to hijack a B-52 bomber and then like protest the war by blowing it up. Not with people in it, but like landing it and then blowing it up.
Pretty cool.
And then he didn't do it because he like went to Thailand and was like starting to figure it out. And then he was like, oh, I can't do this by myself. And he went home. Later, our second tie into the Manhattan Project, opposite side of it, he was a civilian deckhand on a ship that brought medical survey teams out to the Marshall Islands, which is where all the atomic bombs were had been tested, right? And for decades afterwards, they would go and use humans as guinea pigs to see what had happened to the people who had been exposed to all this horrible fucking mass death that the U.S. had done. Mm-hmm.
If you want to know more about the Marshall Islands, I'm just going to plug James Stoudt's series on It Could Happen Here that he did on the Marshall Islands. Check that out.
It is real good, and it's where everything I know about the Marshall Islands comes from.
Yeah.
So he goes out there, and he sees firsthand how everyone has been treated like human guinea pigs. And he's like, man, this is not increasing my theory about the U.S. government and capitalism and it being good. In 1977, he's living in an agricultural area in California. I think he's living, like, later he's in Santa Cruz, but I think he's rural at this point. And his girlfriend is disabled. She'd been exposed to pesticides while working at a cannery. One day, he's driving home, and his crop duster plane flies overhead, and he just gets a face full of pesticides before he can roll up the window. And he's recently been reading Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring and another book from a local professor about pesticides. He writes up a report of the incident for the agricultural commissioner, and nothing came of it. So he's like, yeah, all right, I'm going to do something about this. In 1977, he took the first action as the ELF. This one has nothing, whatever, I'll just... He used an air gun to shoot out the windows of a vacation home of a county supervisor. And he did this because, quote, the action was in retaliation for the jailhouse death of Larry Williams, a young black inmate. He went into diabetic shock and died for lack of an insulin shot. The county supervisor whose windows he shot out, the vacation home of, later went on to be known a little bit more as Dianne Feinstein. Oh, who was mayor of San Francisco. Yeah. And then U.S. senator and paved the way for the antediluvian rule of the country.
Well, great timing.
I don't usually expect to get a Feinstein drop in this podcast.
Feinstein. That's, you can tell because I didn't even know how to pronounce her name. But what I also don't know how to pronounce are the names of all of our advertisers because they're randomly generated. And if you have problems with them, it's because capitalism is a nightmare machine that we're all trapped inside of and the machine is bleeding to death.
Help me.
Here's some ads.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this.
I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter. That's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black. Directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R. Under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
This is Raquel Willis from Queer Chronicles. Right now, there are close to 500 anti-LGBTQ plus bills in state legislatures across the country. Lambda Legal is leading the charge against these hateful bills that target mostly trans and non-binary people. You can fight discrimination and help write the next chapter of Lambda Legal history. To learn more about their open cases and to donate, visit lambdalegal.org. That's lambdalegal.org.
And we're back. And so the ELF, the Environmental Life Force, took credit for that attack on Feinstein.
She's dead.
Yeah, whatever. Then on May 1st, He tried to set fire to 7 crop dusters at a local airport, which makes sense. They'd just been dousing him with poison.
Fair enough.
He's real careful to make sure that no one's hurt. He sets the timers to go off at 2 a.m. The napalm is constructed carefully not to spread the fire, and I will not be talking about how he did that.
Thank you.
That's going to come up a couple times, how I am not talking about some of this shit. We'll talk about why, because people get arrested for talking about it, which is fucked up. Anyway. And then he waits around the crime scene, ready to intercept anyone who might show up who could accidentally get hurt. It's like an airport in the middle of nowhere, but he's like, not taking any chances. He's like, I will go down before anyone gets hurt for my actions.
Huh. I love that.
Yeah. He also didn't make the firebombs right. The blasting caps go off, but not the napalm. And he pretty much just scuffed the paint on the planes. He writes this communique. Sorry, the ELF writes this communique. Almost certainly just him, but people want to have their things that they say. He wants to say that there's a whole bunch of them, so that's great. And in the communique, he's like listing off alternatives to pesticides. Then he drove up to Oregon and bombed a paper company office in Oregon City.
Fair enough.
On August 1st. And the reason he did this, they owned a tree farm that sprayed herbicides, and the herbicides were leaching into streams and killing salmon and shit. So locals had chained themselves to trees to try and stop the paper company, right? So a helicopter sprayed all the activists with herbicide.
Jesus.
So John Hanna drove up there and set a small pipe bomb at their offices. He was really unexcited about people being sprayed with chemicals. Again, no one was hurt. In this case, he actually writes about how he was like, he wasn't even like, the later ELF is trying to maximize economic damage. He's just trying to get attention, like draw attention to things. So it's like a small pipe bomb that like blows out a window. Then on November 22nd, 1977, the ATF and local SWAT arrested him in his house in Santa Cruz because they traced the copy machine that the communiques had been copied on. And basically, yeah, like there's like ways that copy machines like and printers actually leave specific like traceable information. And so they figured out where they were being printed off at, went to the place and was like, hey, any of your employees have a problem with the environment and how it's been treated? And like his girlfriend worked there.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So he told them he'd acted alone. And then he says in interviews, like as late as 2008, he's like, look, there's no statute of limitations on terrorism. So I'm going to continue to tell you that I acted alone, which is his like wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Maybe I didn't act alone. I think he worked alone. Again, whatever, not a problem. But he got sentenced to 5 years in prison. After a bit, he was out on probation. He genuinely sees what he did as counterproductive. This isn't a like, I told the judge, hey, bud, I'm sorry. Wish I hadn't done it. If I could go, if only I could take it back, turn back time, that song, you know. Anyway. And one of the reasons he changed his mind is because he talked with one of the activists who'd been sprayed with herbicide up in Oregon. And that person told him that after the bombing, the activists lost all credibility and the campaign fell apart. He became a strong believer in strict nonviolence. He also, and I think this strains credulity, he claims that he knew the founder of the next incarnation of the ELF over in the UK and that he tried to talk the person out of it. So let's talk about that next incarnation about 15 years later. This is the main one we're going to discuss this week. The actual ELF, the one with more than one person in it, may or may not have gotten inspiration from the environmental life force. But I can point to two very specific places it absolutely did come from. First, Earth First. You ever heard of Earth First?
Yeah, I do. That's the group that I remember most being active or kind of knowing about tangentially in the mid-2000s when I was growing up.
Yeah, I did Earth First organizing in Portland in the mid-2000s while you were growing up.
Yeah, yep.
Earth First, which I've, whatever, I'm pretty public about that. They're an above-ground organization. I talked about them a bunch. If people want to hear me talk more about Earth First, I talk about them in my episode about Judy Berry, who is an anarchist organizer who was bombed probably by the feds in the year 1990. I'm going to rudely split Earth First into two parts of its history. The original and then what it's been for most of its existence since. The first version, the early years of Earth First, had the unofficial slogan, Rednecks for Wilderness. They were one organization in which its members did both nonviolent civil disobedience and also a whole bunch of sabotage. They called it monkey wrenching.
Hmm.
And this is named after a book by
Edward
some
Abbey.
People's problematic fave. Yeah. Probably we'll do an episode about the monkey wrenchers at some point. Two tensions started cropping up within Earth First. First, there was this tension between the, quote, tofu-eating anarchists, who were also mostly actually rural and rednecks, but they were, like, more feminist, anti-authoritarian, and less into the American flag.
Hmm.
And some of, but not all of the founders, who were like, the American flag is our symbol, we are rednecks, just like Edward Abbey, we think it's cool to throw beer cans out the window while we're fighting for the environment. You know, whatever. I have very low opinions of Edward Abbey. I feel very bad. One of my friends is like, you're going to do an episode on Edward Abbey? And I'm like, I am not. He was a xenophobe who believed in closed borders and very NIMBY, whatever, anyway.
Yeah, the libertarian river that runs through all this is, you know, there are many rapids.
Yeah, totally. Totally. So, in the end, the tofu-eating anarchists won and the American flag wavers left. This is... many of the founders made this transition to this new version of the group or were always the tofu-eating anarchists. And when I've talked with people who are from that period, they say that these divisions are like kind of overblown. And like really, like one of the main histories of Earth First was written a while ago and it was written by a journalist who very, very much was on the side of one of the original like Redneck for Wilderness guys. And so like it colors a lot of the media narrative where people are looking for a split that wasn't whatever. Anyway, there's less bad blood than people say, but there's another tension that could not last in an organization. The tension of having an above ground organization like Earth First, they don't have a membership roster and is decentralized, but they have meetings and they have gatherings and they like do things in public and they chain themselves to things and shit, right? If you're doing that, you can't be the same group that burns things at night.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this tension between above ground illegalism, like tree sitting and road blockades, and underground illegalism, like tree spiking and arson and, you know, destroying bulldozers and stuff. The New Earth First didn't condemn the underground stuff. They just didn't do it. It was separate. Lots of imprisoned arsonists came out of Earth First ranks, and Earth First and related organizations ran and run legal support campaigns for these prisoners. But it was distinct from Earth First itself. And this isn't like wink, wink, nudge, nudge, hand waving. It's true. I was involved in Earth First a fair amount, and I never knew. Whenever people would get caught for felony stuff, I'd be like, holy shit, really? You know? Because it was separate. Earth First is still around. Its slogan is No Compromise in Defense of the Earth. I like them. That has probably come across. And then there's another origin point where the Earth Liberation Front gets its name, which is not, I don't know why I'm like picking a fight with this old guy who's probably, whatever. They didn't get their name from the old one. They got it from the Animal Liberation Front. You ever heard of the Animal Liberation Front?
Yes, but weirdly only through a T.C. Boyle story, which is an embarrassing way to learn about the world. Because it's about, I feel like so many of his stories were just like, I met a hot woman who was doing something strange. And it's about like dating an ALF activist.
Cool. Wait, if you think of the story, will you let me know what it is? I really like tracing representation of this type of group in fiction.
It's a short story called Carnal Knowledge.
Okay. Okay. That
perfect.
Sounds dirty old man, but you know.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Carnal Knowledge. It does. It does. It does.
Also the name of the movie where Jack Nicholson played a college student when he was like 39 years old, but that's a separate issue.
Oh God.
Yeah.
So the Animal Liberation Front. My disclaimer here. I have been vegan for long enough that my veganism is old enough to drink at bars. I am overall supportive of the Animal Liberation Front and a lot of its things, but my support is not without caveats in this. And specifically, I have a lot of issues with the way that vegan activism is done. I don't believe eating animals is inherently morally wrong. And I don't have an issue with people who hunt for food. And I support indigenous fishing and hunting rights in particular.
Mm-hmm.
I think that a lot of animal rights activism is too black and white. And I have issues with a lot of it. That said, when people rescue animals and give them new homes and care for them, I am happy.
Mm-hmm.
At the core of it, that is what the Animal Liberation Front does. At the core of it is, you know, they go into places where they believe animals are being mistreated and they take those animals out and they find them sanctuary.
Hmm.
I will probably not do an ALF episode. Maybe one day. I don't know. I'm going to speed run them really quick.
Hmm.
In the 19th century in England, speed run, I'm going back to the 19th century. You had all of these teach kids to be nice to animals organizations called Bands of Mercy, which is a cool name. They stuck around for a while and then they petered out. Then in 1963, you have the Hunt Saboteurs Association that forms in England. They would go around and like fuck up staghound hunting events, which is not where people hunt staghounds. That's when they use staghounds to hunt stags.
I had no idea that that was a thing people did. It does seem like less cartoonishly scary and British than fox hunting. But yeah, wow. Ugh.
Yeah. It's like, you know, you're always rooting for whatever king to get gored when this happens.
Oh, but yeah.
It happens so rarely. So volunteers would start showing up in the 60s and blow hunting horns and put down false scents and shit to disrupt the hunts. Some of the hunt saboteurs took up the name Band of Mercy. And started slashing hunters' tires and breaking windows.
Mm.
And again, whatever. We're not talking about like the deer hunter in Kentucky. We are talking about a class-based thing in England. In 1973, they burned down a pharmaceutical research laboratory, the Band of Mercy. In 1974, they burned down some boats that were seal hunting. Then they liberated 6 guinea pigs, the first direct animal liberation of the movement.
Wow.
And then something that happened that I think is really important, which gets at the core of the strategic complexity of this kind of action, happened. The hunt saboteurs were like, hey, these guys ain't us about Band of Mercy. We blow horns and stuff. We don't slash tires. That's a step too far. We also don't, I mean, whatever. They went from slashing tires to burning things down. But they also offered a reward to anyone who ratted out the Band of Mercy. Which is a classic, we agree with your morals, but not your tactics, combined with the classic, and we'll sell you out to the system we claim to hate in order to curry favor from that system. In 1976, some arrested Band of Mercy folks got out of prison and changed the name to the Animal Liberation Front, which is certainly more hardcore, but Band of Mercy is a pretty good name. Just saying.
It's fucking fantastic. And with the Animal Liberation Front, I really... I'm stuck on the fact that they only needed 2 more words and then they could have been Alfie.
But now they're an alien that eats cats.
Yeah, that's good too.
God, wait. Alf must have come after this. Alf is 80s, right?
Right. So
was Alf named after the
animal? I certainly hope so.
Yeah. I'm just going to say yes. Absolutely.
It's headcanon. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a complicated show, you know?
Yeah. I watched it as a kid and have not thought about it since. But I had an Alf skateboard when I was in middle school.
Oh, nice.
And it was he was skateboarding on the skateboard.
Oh, so it was recursive skateboard.
Space. Yeah.
I always liked it when also you would have as a kid like a Spider-Man costume and then there would be a graphic of Spider-Man on the chest. And as a kid, I was like, this completely takes me out of it. What kind of a superhero would wear a smaller image of themselves on their own clothes?
And yet here you are wearing a sweater with your face on it.
Does that sweater have your face on it?
No, but it has a whale with a neutral expression. This is for the White Whale bookstore in Pittsburgh. Aww. And their mascot is a little whale who's just happy to be here, I like to think.
For the record, I did not know it was on the shirt before I said the joke that I made.
But I mean, like, on my best days, I feel like I'm just a whale, just, you know, swimming around, sifting out tons of krill with my baleen.
Well, now I feel bad because actually one of the actions that didn't get claimed by the ALF but was a very ALF-y action in the first one that happened in the U.S., I think, was a group of people who freed some whales in a free willy kind of way.
Yeah. Well, the 90s in the Northwest were also a big time for whales. What with, Keiko?
I would say, in a way, Sarah, do you not blow us all out of the water?
Honey!
Honey!
So, the ALF, when they form, they laid out a structure that went on to define what this sort of leaderless resistance looks like. There's no central registry. There's no leadership. Anyone who adheres to the basic guidelines can call themselves ALF. One of those central tenets is you have to adhere to that all precautions must be in place to protect human and non-human animal life.
Mm-hmm.
Above ground groups started to form to support underground activists, like they had a press office and magazines and websites and legal support funds and all that shit. And they set about gluing locks, freeing animals, burning shit, slashing tires, spray painting, running targeted and focused activist campaigns to shut down vivisectors. And within a few years, it hit the U.S., and so the ALF came out of the ALF and it came out of Earth First. And I got one more foundation to describe that is as much of a bedrock as these ads are the bedrock of being able to pay people a living wage to read history books about arsonists. Here's ads.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this.
I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter. That's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
This is Raquel Willis from Queer Chronicles. Right now, there are close to 500 anti-LGBTQ plus bills in state legislatures across the country. Lambda Legal is leading the charge against these hateful bills that target mostly trans and non-binary people. You can fight discrimination and help write the next chapter of Lambda Legal history. To learn more about their open cases and to donate, visit lambdalegal.org. That's lambdalegal.org.
And we're back. And we spent our ad time talking about the hot blacksmith in the classic film A Knight's Tale.
We've used our time really well, I think.
When we look back on the heyday of the Earth Liberation Front, it's easy to see it in the context of global warming. And that's how I started the episode. I clearly am framing it that way. And the participants did see it as related to global warming. But at the time, people were talking about something more localized, the destruction of old growth forests and intact ecosystems. Before I moved out west and fell in with the forest defenders, I'd never really seen a clear cut. You live out west. You've gone out and seen the clear cuts all around.
Yeah.
They look like shaved patches on the mountains. You know, they look like a bad punk haircut. Less than 4% of the original forest of the United States is left. Everywhere colonizers have gone, they have left this like absolute nightmare in its wake. I grew up on the East Coast. I imagine that logging was done sustainably because that's what I was told. I was told two trees are planted for every tree cut down. And actually, on one of the documentaries that I watched on this, I think it was If a Tree Falls, I think that was the one. As a timber executive who's like, six trees are planted for every tree we cut down.
We all used to get that commercial.
Yeah. It doesn't even... Yeah. How would you imagine that would work? Then there'd be too many trees in the area.
Yeah, they're like carrots.
Yeah. I mean, that's what they do, is that they replant monocultures.
And then everywhere would have the same lovely infrastructure we have in Portland.
Yeah.
By that, do you mean none, Sophie?
Perhaps.
And it's great because now, you know, what's nice about Portland is that despite the fact that we're decimating the forest all around us, there are still enough old trees to crush people's houses all the time.
Yeah, which is pretty impressive.
It's something.
It's nice that global warming can use the few remaining trees to crush people's houses
to kill people.
The people who actually did anything. Was that one that fell on the cop car?
Yeah, that was a good one.
That was an ally.
That was a good tree.
When I was a kid, I imagined that loggers went into forests and cut like one tree out of 50 so that the forest stayed intact. That they were like, oh, well, we want there to be a forest.
Yeah, you know? Me too.
Yeah, and they go timber and they look really hot while they do it.
They do. And they have those heels on the boots.
Mm-hmm. They sleep all day. They work all night. They hang around in bars.
Yeah.
So that they just actually clear cut acre after acre. And sometimes they say we're not clear cutting, it's selective cuts, after they like would ban clear cutting in certain areas. And if you go out to these selective cuts, it is exactly the same as going out to a clear cut, only there's two trees per acre or something like that. And those trees, if you spend enough time out in the woods, those trees blow over because those trees grew up in a forest with trees around to block the wind.
Mm-hmm.
So speaking of trees falling on people's houses, the National Forest Service is not in the business of protecting forests. That is not its job. I'm not even trying to slander it here. It is in the Department of Agriculture. It is the National Forest Service, because of the timber sale program, is largely a big tree farm sold off to various timber companies, often at a loss to the taxpayers because you can actually get a lot more money out of intact forests through recreation and things like that. And very little of our timber needs come from the national, whatever, anyway. It's I was in Earth First for a while, as it come across. So the Willamette National Forest is one of the most beautiful places in the world. In 1991, some arsonists, not the good kind, started a 9,000-acre forest fire in the Corn Patch roadless area in the forest, which was a habitat reserve for the northern spotted owl. Basically, there was this culture war thing happening in the late 80s, early 90s about the spotted owl, where people were like, we want to cut down everything. And people were like, we'd rather you didn't. And they were like, give us a good reason. And we were like, spotted owl nest there. And then the courts were like, okay. And then the culture war was like, well, then we hate the spotted owl. Fuck the spotted owl. It's woke.
I like vaguely remember that from like my earliest flickerings of consciousness, that like conservatives loved to make weird jokes about the spotted owl. And I was like, I don't get it.
Yeah. They've never changed. So as soon as this place, this in the Corn Patch roadless area, was declared a spotted owl sanctuary, someone burned it.
Mm-hmm.
The Forest Service was like, sweet, the trees burned, we can sell them now in what's called a salvage timber sale, which is based on this entirely incorrect assumption that a burned forest is not a healthy forest and it's good to then take all the biomass out of it.
That's very depressing, but I also want to make my joke that they had a fire sale.
They did have a fire sale.
Sorry.
It's okay. I would bet a decent sum of money that the fire was started for the purpose of turning it into a salvage sale. Light it and log it was the slogan attributed to the timber companies. One of the things that happens a lot in logging is that the fines for, like, for example, one timber sale that I worked on, when they accidentally, quote unquote, cut an old growth tree outside of the like area that they're supposed to cut, they would get fined a couple $1,000s on a tree that they sold for tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
So
God.
There's no criminal punishment, right? So they just do it.
Well, it's like when you see those signs that are like, fine for striking and killing a highway worker, $7,500. And there have to be people who see that and are like, all right.
Yeah, totally. So the arsonist who started that 9,000-acre fire was never caught. I am not sure the fire was ever really investigated seriously. Later in this story, you're going to see like a teenager go to prison for 8 years for doing $5,000 worth of damage to a McDonald's. 300 FBI agents working on a case to bring down one cell of the Earth Liberation Front.
I'm sure they had nothing better to do.
but 9,000 acres of public land, old growth forest, totally irreplaced. Now, who cares? Whatever. Mm-hmm. So this timber sale, the salvage timber sale, set off huge protests. There was a 5-year campaign from 91 to 95, which isn't 5 years, it's 4 years, but whatever. A burned forest is still a valuable ecosystem. And in the West, in particular, forests are often fire ecologies designed to survive and often thrive from burns. You know, I worked one salvage timber sale that we were trying to stop where the pine cones don't open unless there's a fire. You know, the new seeds like literally can't be planted until the fire goes through. That said, the kinds of fires that these are a different deal. But if you don't clear cut a burned forest and remove all the biomass and all the habitat, these forests can recover. And activists knew that, and they started leading hikes through the burn area to talk about fire ecology. In early 1995, they won in court, saying that it shouldn't be logged. But then a Republican Congress passed the Salvage Logging Rider in 1995. And this basically, like, it literally had to go through Congress to say, no, we just want to cut everything we can in this one particular area, basically. Basically, this rider to a different bill said for the next year, any burned forest can be cut without any environmental review. But normally, if you want to cut public lands, you have to at least go through an environmental review process, which is where activists, the glamorous stuff is the tree sitting and the road blockades, but the thing that actually saves the forest are the lawyers fighting that while the blockaders prevent it from being cut while the court is figuring it out. Whatever. The reason this was a rider, this bill, was because it was attached to a different bill. In this case, these fucking ghouls attached it to a bill giving money to Oklahoma City bombing victims.
Oh my God. See, every time we're nostalgic for the 90s, it's like up, 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 up.
Yeah. Nothing changes.
Yeah. The fashions just, you know, waver slightly, but that's about it.
Yeah, but we're back to it again already.
Right. Yeah.
Actually, I think we've already moved on past it.
We're in a little figure eight. Yeah, God knows. I think we're doing 2003 now, which is, ugh.
If I dressed like 2003, no one would come near me.
I got to get a newsboy cap if we're going to do my personal 2003, which Sophie is already gravitating towards. So we can, Sophie, we're going to be newsies this year.
Okay.
That is a good style. Yeah. I am all about the...
Nobody was saying it 20 years ago, but maybe it's finally time.
No, we should. I was saying to my sister-in-law the other day, I was like, I feel no emotional attachment to my wardrobe. I'm like, it doesn't feel like me anymore. So maybe it's because it's not newsies enough.
Maybe your newsies era. Yeah, I identify so deeply with the episode of Seinfeld where Jerry and Elaine are at a funeral. And mm-hmm. Elaine's like, I hate all my clothes.
Yeah.
It's like sometimes when you're at a funeral, that's the saddest thing you can think about.
Yeah.
Anyway. All right. We're all going to get newsboy caps.
Yeah. And then go out and do redacted.
Yeah. I love to do redacted.
The timber companies are like, let's fucking go. Who cares if we kill the planet? We'll be able to buy new trucks. And this massive protest movement, it doesn't go away just because Congress told them that the law wasn't going to work with them anymore. Mm-hmm. It moved to a more sort of desperate direct action movement. Over 600 people got arrested defending various forests in the area that summer. Just massive protests were everywhere. One of the main groups involved was a new group called Cascadia Forest Defenders. Mm-hmm. And it's not Earth First, but it's not Earth First. The direct action environmental movement is like that, where you'll just... You know, Portland had the Cascadia Forest Alliance, Eugene had the Cascadian Forest Defenders, whatever. And because of all of this, the Forest Service only managed to sell a fifth of the billion board feet of timber that they'd hoped out of the salvage rider, because lawsuits and activists kept tangling everything up. And there was this particular 14-acre sale, Warner Creek, and it suddenly opened for logging. So a couple activists grabbed their toothbrushes and sleeping bags and run up the hill. And they just stay there. And then they keep staying there for almost a year, 343 days, all through the winter, under 8 feet of snow. And along the way, hundreds of people, a total of 500 to 1,000 people, come to this encampment. Hmm. They rip up the road with pickaxes, which is, they build 15-foot deep, 10-foot wide trenches in the road. They built a palisade wall like in Wild West town with a drawbridge and an observation tower. And they buried anchor points in the road to lock themselves to. These are called sleeping dragons, you know, because you just grab a chain with a carabiner around your wrist, and then you like run to a hidden point in the road, stick your arm into it, and you can clip into this point, and then they can't take you out. They called it the Cascadia Free State, and they made a documentary about it called Pickaxe that's worth watching. It was made by the participants. And it's all 90s camcorder. It's kind of wild. It looked like shit when I saw it. And then now it probably looks cool and old and people do it on purpose.
Yeah, it's an artifact.
Yeah. Two activists went to the federal building in Eugene and went on a hunger strike, all to protect this 14-acre timber sale. Or rather, to make a bigger point and draw attention and build a community around this movement. The following summer, on August 16th, the Forest Service came in with heavy equipment and arrested 7 people and tore the whole thing down. One of the kind of wild things about these encampments is that they rely on, like, all this could, anything you can do with a pickaxe over the course of months or a year can be destroyed in a few hours with heavy equipment, you know? But the timber sale was canceled, as were a ton of other salvage sales, because everyone in the area, from the hippies to the little old ladies, were fucking mad about it. People kept like storming offices. When some folks were arrested, their arraignment was held in secret. And so the activists outside were like, nah, that's not going to happen. Protesters forced their way into the jail and rioted in Eugene. This particular movement, based in Eugene, Oregon, is going to have a worldwide impact. It basically brings hippie anti-capitalism into the modern era. It rebirths the U.S. direct action anarchist movement, which later goes on to influence a ton of stuff through the anti-globalization movement and up through Occupy and onward.
Wow. Boy, a lot has come out of Eugene.
Yeah. And protesters spent a lot of time in these makeshift shelters in the snow, holding off the federal government. And they got to talking. You know, there's like only a couple of them that stick around all winter. And they're like, hey, what is necessary and what is ethical and what is strategic? How do we stop not just this timber sale, but the death machine of global capitalism? So a ton of people from this group formed the most prolific cell of the Earth Liberation Front, and they met each other there and they grew close on a road in the middle of nowhere buried under snow. Meanwhile, after a decade of ecotage, Earth First formally splits from the underground action. This is now we're playing fast and loose with time here. Now we're back to 1992 in Brighton, England, where a lot of punk stuff comes from. And they were like, all right, if you're doing above ground shit, you're Earth First. If you're doing ecotage, which is their like cool word for sabotage in the name of the Earth, then you're the Earth Liberation Front and good luck to you, but you're not us. The Animal Liberation Front had gotten its legs in England, so it makes sense enough that the ELF did too. In April 1992, the Earth Liberation Front made its first attack, or at least the first one with a communique. They attacked a peat company called Fizzens that was destroying peat bogs, which are a non-renewable resource, something that is only just now coming to mainstream like attention. Like, you know, people used to always like use peat moss a lot in gardening, right? And people are moving to alternatives because they're like, oh, peat moss doesn't come back.
I had no idea.
Yeah, peat moss doesn't come back. Don't use it. Coconut something.
The thing no one can say. Quar, quar, quar. It's like Creed Bratton trying to remember his job title. Quabity, qual. But yeah.
I have no idea what word you're trying to say.
Is it the coconut quar, right? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I probably never said it aloud. I've just like,
I know. I'm afraid to.
Gardening articles. Yeah. And I think this is actually an example of the kind of thing that the Earth Liberation Front is doing, is being about 30 years ahead of its time and confronting issues that at the time were like, what? Who cares? And now people are like, oh, we care because we're all about to boil. This magazine called Green Anarchist, not to be confused with the U.S. magazine Green Anarchy, put out this first communique. All our peat bogs must be preserved in their entirety for the sake of the plants, the animals, and our national heritage. Cynically donating small amounts will do no good. The water table will drop and the bogs will dry out and die unless it is preserved fully. And so the ELF spreads across Europe and the rest of the world. Most of the narratives around the Earth Liberation Front collapse the whole movement down to a few people, especially this cell that we're going to talk about, which gets called the family, which is sketchy. If you're ever naming your own group, don't name it the family.
Yeah.
And we're going to collapse the narrative down to them a little bit, too, for three reasons. One, it is narratively convenient. Two, we know the most about it. And three, well, because not everyone involved in all these actions has been caught, and there's no statute of limitations on terrorism charges, so I don't really want to dig into some of these things, you know? But fittingly enough, the first recorded ELF action in the U.S. was on Columbus Day, and it was some graffiti about colonization. Mm. 504 years of genocide was spray-painted in one place. ELF was spray-painted in another place. In Eugene, Oregon, naturally.
Perfect.
And then, because they hadn't really nailed their security culture yet, for a few days later, all along the I-5 corridor, just in a single direction, gas stations and McDonald's had their glues locked with 504 years of genocide and Earth Liberation Front and fuck corporations and all that jazz. Then, a week or so later, the first fire that they're famous for happened. It was 1996. It's in the forest outside Detroit, Oregon.
Mm.
The other Detroit, as it's often referred
famously.
To.
Famously.
Yeah.
This one has a lake.
Yeah. It's like people are like, which Portland? And you're like, unless you live in Maine, no one's going to ask which Portland you mean.
Truly. Come on, you guys.
They're like, but it's a capital. And you're like, yeah. Anyway, in the forest outside Detroit, Oregon, a U.S. Forest Service pickup truck was burned down. An incendiary device was found on the roof of the ranger station, but it never ignited. And just like that, the U.S. Earth Liberation Front kicked off. As for how that went, we'll talk about it on Wednesday.
And just like that.
Honey.
Honey.
You don't like my cliffhanger?
No, it's an it, you didn't get it. There's the Sex and the City remake is called And Just Like That.
I get really excited when I do know pop culture references.
No, you did not need to know this pop culture reference, but when you said it, it was meant to be.
My first thought hearing all this is that these are movements that, because they felt fully formed by the time I was a teenager, I just assumed had been around kind of forever. And
oh yeah, huh.
To me, one of the most interesting parts of this is being like, no, this the beginning of this large scale movement, we can trace it to an exact point in time and space.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about that before. I think I also kind of had this like sense of like, oh, this is just this thing. It's just in the air. And then like, it kind of goes away too, right? It's this like grand leaderless movement that's been around forever. And it's like, it kind of did a thing for about 10 years.
Yeah. Well, and on a more pop cultural level, it's so funny to trace the eras of things that we could focus on as a society. Like the 90s were the era of Save the Whales, to the extent that I feel like this is a weird way to track cultural relevancy, but it's what comes to mind. I think there's a compilation of Dilbert cartoons called Shave the Whales, so you can see how well known that phrase was. I read a lot of comic book compilations as a kid. I was not a great reader. Or just like, not even real comic books, but just, you know, newspaper funny pages. But I remembered, because Earth First has such a ring to me in my high school brain, I wrote for an open mic night senior year of high school a song parody of Phil Oakes's Love Me, I'm a Liberal, but I called it Love Me, I'm a Portlander. And it had an Earth First reference.
Love Me, I'm a what? I didn't hear what you said.
Love Me, I'm a Liberal.
And yeah, then, no, but what was your version?
Love Me, I'm a Portlander.
Love Me, I'm a Portlander.
You don't even have to change anything.
I know. Well, I guess updated it for modern times, although I didn't do a great job, but yeah, and for people who don't know, Love Me, I'm a Liberal is, I think it's a wonderful, like, biting satire song. Phil Oakes was a folk singer who I think said that he sang all the news that was fit to sing, or something like that, and had a brief and tragic life and was very attractive, as folk singers all are in one way or another. And Love Me, I'm a Liberal is like this very catchy, jaunty folk song about having radical values at one time and then selling out and feeling pretty happy with that. And the sort of punchline of the song is, "And that's why I'm turning you in."
Yeah. That's a perfect song for this moment. And yeah, that was what was in the air on your, because you were in high school during a lot of what we're going to be talking about, I think. Maybe. Well, I don't actually know. Yeah.
Well, and I wonder about, you know, just looking ahead, how much what we're talking about feels present in the current moment where we're having this, it feels like unending mainstream cultural debate between, should we fuck shit up or should we buy pasta in glass jars?
And I say, why not both?
I knew that. I literally knew that was what you were going to say. I was like, Magpie was like, I will not choose.
I know.
I will not choose.
My two big things I'm always saying is decant everything. Put all your hand soap into a prettier bottle and all your pasta into glass jars and fuck shit up. That's the two.
I am okay with living by both of those. Sarah?
Yeah.
I think that's how we have to do it. And also, you got a carbo load if you're going to fuck shit up.
The revolution can be interior designed.
That was really funny, Magpie.
Thanks.
Yeah, that was beautiful.
Thanks.
Put that on a fucking bumper sticker, please. Yeah. That is perfect.
No, put it on like a live, laugh, love like cross stitch that's framed.
Exact. Oh, so, yes.
A throw pillow.
Yeah. They need to sell that at Home Goods. We don't need any other pillows that say grateful.
Yeah.
We need pillows that say pissed off.
Yeah.
But if people want to be grateful for hearing more of you on podcasts, where can they find you?
Oh, that was so beautiful.
Thanks.
I have two podcasts. Can you believe it? In this day and age, everyone has a podcast. So I had to have two to feel special. So I do a podcast called You're Wrong About, where we talk about misremembered history. I really have got to have both of you on at some point in the future. And recently we've talked about everything from The Exorcist to Billie Jean King. So there's something for everyone. And it's not all about the 70s, despite what those two examples made it sound like. And then I do You Are Good, which I co-host with Alex Steed, and which is a feelings podcast about movies. And we recently did an episode that's our live show where we talk about Forrest Gump with Chelsea Weber Smith at SF Sketchfest. And we had such a great time. And there's nothing like crying a little bit in front of people who paid to come watch you cry a little bit.
Yeah, with the microphone and Zoom, you can pretend like there's not an audience. But
yeah, you're like, I'm just having a moment with the shampoo bottle I've been holding since I was 5.
Yeah. Okay, well, if people want to see more of what I do, they can look at pictures of my dog on Instagram at Margaret Killjoy, and they can follow me on Substack at Margaret Killjoy, and my most recent book is a tabletop role-playing game called Penumbra City. So if you want to fuck shit up safely with your friends, you can do that. Okay, wait. How I'm going to try and tie it together. When I was organizing Earth First in Portland in the mid-aughts, I was running a Dungeons & Dragons game. And wow, I don't know the legality of what I'm about to say. I would give in-game rewards to when my players would get arrested at Earth First events. No one was like planning. Well, actually, Earth First often plans to get people arrested. But, you know, one of my players, you know, spent a night in jail and was interrogated by the FBI or whatever because it was green scare times. And literally, they had just hung a banner in a tree and got tackled in her. This is a complete tangent. Sophie, you got anything you want to plug?
Yeah, I'll plug Cool Zone Media's newest podcast. It's called Better Offline. It is all about how big tech and Silicon Valley is infiltrating our minds and our daily lives. So check that out. It's a weekly podcast every Wednesday.
Mm. God bless you, Cool Zone.
Oh, God bless you, Sarah Marshall.
Yeah. God bless us, everyone.
Exactly what I was thinking. Bye.
Cool People Who Did Cool Stuff is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more podcasts from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
This is Raquel Willis from Queer Chronicles. Right now, there are close to 500 anti-LGBTQ plus bills in state legislatures across the country. Lambda Legal is leading the charge against these hateful bills that target mostly trans and non-binary people. You can fight discrimination and help write the next chapter of Lambda Legal history. To learn more about their open cases and to donate, visit lambdalegal.org. That's lambdalegal.org.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.